Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners of Minnesota Mining v. Nishiki.
May it please the court. Ms. Marie Yates will present argument to petitioners. The petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor, in this case, the Beaumont Court of Appeals has extended the reach of warranty liability under Uniform Commercial Code Section 2318 further than any court in the country. But I want to start with the choice of law point that Your Honor is going to read on point number 14, because the choice of law point in this case is dispositive. Had the choice of law been correctly determined below, we would never have had to decide the outer reach of UCC warranty liability under alternative C of section 2318.
Well, we say Nevada is the most significant contact. At the end of the story, go home.
That's
forget about the UCC and options A, B, and C.
You won't be able to forget about option A, because option A is the law in Nevada. And under option A, even the plaintiffs don't dispute that the camera manufacturer and the camera distributor, who are outside the chain of distribution, cannot recover these pure economic losses. And that's why I want to start with choice of law. But you remember what happened here is that 3M sold one product, the new emulsion, to plaintiff Lintec in Georgia, who resold it to plaintiff Nishika in Nevada. 3M sold a second product, the backcoat sauce, to plaintiff Nishika in Nevada. Nishika in Nevada puts the two together and processes the film in the so-called the photograph space. But the issue here is not whether these folks in the distributed chain, whoever acquired the products, can get pure economic losses. The issue is whether the camera manufacturer and the camera distributor, who claim that there was a decline in consumer confidence in their cameras because the photographs faded, can get there under UCC Section 2318. Now let me show you why we think Nevada law should govern. As we mentioned, the backcoat sauce is made in Minnesota. That's true. Or I should say a component of the backcoat sauce, component part A, comes in a can. It's marked component A. That's shipped into and delivered in Nevada, and Nishika in Nevada mixes it up with some other stuff and creates the backcoat sauce, and then puts the backcoat sauce together with the new emulsion. The new emulsion comes from Italy, not Minnesota. Now, the whole case here, the whole breach of warranty case here, was based on the fact that these two things, the new emulsion and the backcoat sauce, were incompatible, that they didn't work together. Here's Mr. Bainbridge. He's the plaintiff who owns three of the plaintiff companies, I should say. He said the only crucial thing is that the two products didn't work together. Here's Mr. Sussman, the plaintiff's counsel. The reason that there was a breach of warranty is because these two products that only came together in Nevada didn't work together. And here's Mr. Sussman's closing argument, where he skillfully convinces the jury to find a breach of warranty because these two products that were supposed to work together, were supposed to be used together, couldn't work together. Now, the only place they came together was in Nevada. And Restatement 188 of the Conflict of Laws that this court has adopted for contracts in the Duncan case provides that the contacts have to be evaluated according to their significance to the issues in the case. If the whole issue in the case is breach of warranty, and the only way you get a breach is that two things don't work together, and the only place they come together is Nevada, we think that's a pretty significant contact. And it's exactly what our trial counsel told the trial court as to why Nevada law should control. He said the two things only came together in Nevada. The sun never shined on this product. If you look at it as the two things together in Minnesota, remember the new emulsion never was in Minnesota. So we think that if you look at the location of the subject matter, which, for example, is one of the Restatement 188 contacts, the location of subject matter here would clearly be Nevada. But what do the plaintiffs say? The plaintiffs say that the contract, 3M performed the contract in Minnesota because a part of a part, that backcoat component part A, came out of Minnesota. But the emulsion came out of Italy. And Restatement 188 says in the comments, if the performance is divided between two jurisdictions, here Minnesota and Italy, that have different laws, the conduct of the place of performance doesn't count. So what about the place of negotiations? The plaintiffs have repeatedly said this contract was negotiated in Minnesota. The truth of the matter is, remember, only face-to-face negotiations count under Restatement 188. And there were some initial face-to-face meetings in Minnesota before the new emulsion was ever developed, before the stuff at issue in this case was ever developed. The only face-to-face meeting concerning the new emulsion took place in Lintec in Georgia. And remember, Georgia also has alternative A. The restatement provides that if two states have the same law, in this case Georgia and Nevada, you cumulate their contacts. So, the location, the subject matter, the place where the two things came together is Nevada. That's alternative A. The place of negotiations, the only place, by the way, where 3M allegedly made the express warranty for which we got hit with liability, that 3M allegedly expressly said the new emulsion will work with the back coats off, that was at the meeting in Georgia at Lintec. So the express warranty was made in Georgia. That's an alternative A state. So all the contacts point to alternative A. Now, what about the policy factors? I mean, this court has said in Duncan and in Matches that the contacts in Section 188 have to be informed by the policy. Well, one of the policy factors in Section 6 is the justified expectations of the parties. And there's a very interesting thing in that regard. When Lintec in Georgia resold the new emulsion to Machika in Nevada, they put a choice of law clause in their contract. This is in the record. And they selected Nevada law because that's where the stuff was going to be used. So the justified expectations of these plaintiffs would have been, we believe, with respect to our contract, that since the stuff was going to be used in Nevada, that Nevada law would control. Now, what about the interest of the jurisdictions, the states in question? Nevada and Georgia, of course, is the states, or are the states, where the plaintiffs are domiciled, where they do business, and where they use the goods. Those states, you would think, would have the most appropriate interest in what their consumers should recover. But those states have limited their consumers' recovery. So they don't have, Georgia and Nevada don't have any interest in applying the more expansive Minnesota law to their consumers, because if they did have such an interest, they wouldn't have adopted alternative A. Now what about the interest of Minnesota in having its more expansive liability law applied? If you look at the cases that we cited in our brief, and we cited a half a dozen cases where the courts have recognized that the state where the manufacturer is domiciled, the state of domicile of the manufacturer, doesn't have any interest in having its more expansive liability law applied to stick its manufacturers with more liability than they would have under the law of the state where the consumer lives and the goods are going to be used. And so we say that the contacts, if they formulated the warranty issue the way the plaintiffs formulated the warranty issue, the policy factors, everything points to alternative A. And if this case had been decided under alternative A, there would be no need for the Beaumont Court or for this court to decide what is the outer reach, what is the outer limit of UCC warranty law. But instead, the Beaumont Court was down here at the outer reach is under alternative C. And what did the Beaumont Court say? Anybody who's reasonably expected to be affected, because that's what the statute says on its face, no need to construe it, anybody that's affected. And the Beaumont Court was led into error in that regard.
Wait. Before you get into that,
yes,
let me ask you a question about which law applies. And that is, I'm going to presume that the other side is going to get up here and give us some reasons why Minnesota law should apply. If there were some reasons why Minnesota law should apply, mm-hmm. but let's say there's more reasons why Nevada law should apply.
Yes, sir.
My question is, what is the standard of review?
It's de novo, Your Honor. This is a question of law. This court said this repeatedly in your choice of law cases. Look at Maxis, look at Duncan. It's a question of law for this court to decide. There's no deference to the courts below on that issue. Now, they led the Beaumont Court into error on warranty because they repeatedly told the Beaumont Court that this was a family of companies related to the buyer. Now, look, this is page 3 of their brief of appellee. If you don't believe me, look at this. 6 times on page 3 they said family of companies, family of companies. But, Your Honor, this was never a family of companies at the time these goods were sold. These are the plaintiffs that were submitted in the jury charge, and these are the entities that existed at the time 3M sold the goods in question. Now, what's wrong with this picture? What's wrong with this picture is that Machika Manufacturing Hong Kong, the camera manufacturer that they submitted to the jury, didn't even exist when the goods were sold. And the camera manufacturer that did exist, Quantronics, was not in Mr. Bainbridge's family of companies because at that time it wasn't owned at all by Mr. Bainbridge.
Ms. So Yates?
Yes, sir.
Don't they say that Hong Kong got an assignment from Quantronics to have this implied warranty breach?
They do, Your Honor, and it's very interesting. They ran out in the middle of trial and they got a faxed in assignment that was never put before the jury. There is no evidence in this jury of an assignment.
That's your second point, that they didn't prove an assignment.
That's right.
But assume that there was an assignment. Can't somebody buy a breach of warranty claim from somebody else? Just
Your
for
Honor,
business purposes?
Perhaps.
Whether
perhaps.
They were in existence or not when the breach occurred?
Perhaps they can, Your Honor, but there's no evidence in this record
right,
of that.
But that's a different entity.
That's right.
Your argument keeps saying they were never in existence, therefore they can't sue.
That's right.
But that's not technically correct, is it?
Well, let me say about that point of error. That is our point that we're making that goes with respect to whether you ought to determine that those people are reasonably expected to be foreseeable when you're talking about folks outside the chain of distribution. That's really what we're going to when we say they didn't exist. That you can't, even if they're right and you make some kind of ad hoc determination on a case-by-case basis of who's reasonably within law foreseeable, you wouldn't say Nishika Manufacturing that didn't even exist and that we didn't know about was foreseeable. That's really where we intend.
That's if you get stuck with an alternative C.
Right, exactly, which we don't even think we should be looking at.
I understand.
Right. So they were never a family of companies. Now, so what are we left with? We're left with the Beaumont Court of Appeals saying, if you're reasonably expected to be affected, you can get there under alternative C. And it's interesting because the Beaumont Court says, this is a broad, expansive, far-reaching holding. And it sure is, because look at the Bridge case. This is from the Nebraska Innkeepers case that we cite in our brief. If I'm the manufacturer of the steel, and I sell the steel to make the bridge, when I sell the steel, I know that there's businesses up and down the river that are going to be economically dependent on the bridge. Those folks are reasonably expected to be affected if my steel is no good and the bridge fails. Under their theory, everybody up and down the river recovers in breach of warranty. Now, I'm sure Mr. Powers is going to say, oh, no, we're not everybody up and down the river. There are only four of us, and we told 3M about the four of us. They didn't tell us about Nishika Manufacturing. We didn't know about that one, and that's one of the ones that recovered. But then the plaintiffs say, well, you knew there had to be a camera manufacturer out there. Well, if I knew there had to be a camera manufacturer out there, and if that's enough to stick me with warranty liability, then what about the company that makes the batteries for the camera? I know somebody has to be out there making batteries for the camera. I know somebody has to be making accessories for the camera. The ripple effect within the economy of construing the statute to mean that anybody that's reasonably expected can get there is enormous.
If they shut down ahead of time and said, look, for reasons that don't have anything to do with you, we've split this up four ways, but this is all one enterprise. Mm-hmm. And if something goes wrong, we don't know which one of us is going to affect, but we're all going to look to you for the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be enough to get you?
No, sir, it would not, because legally there's no such thing as all one enterprise. These are separate corporations. Each one is a separate legal juridical entity. And just because they want to call themselves an enterprise does not mean that in law they can turn themselves into one entity.
Well, if they had a joint venture agreement.
Well, there was one in this case, Your Honor.
I didn't say that. Well, what if they did?
I don't think that that would make any difference, because
they'd make them a joint enterprise, wouldn't they?
Well, it could conceivably make them a joint enterprise, Your Honor, but I'm getting ready to argue to you that the place where we think the courts should draw the line on warranty law is determined by whether you're inside or outside the chain of distribution. So we would argue that even if there was a joint venture, that you should draw the line at pure economic losses. And I'm not talking about personal injury, I'm not talking about property damage, but if it's pure economic losses, the proper place to draw the line for breach of warranty under 2318 is it pure economic losses for people outside the chain of distribution.
Opposing counsel said this argument's all well and good and novel, but you didn't preserve it below.
Your Honor, I don't know where that's coming from, because we have, from the get-go, in the trial court, we've complained about these two entities outside the chain couldn't recover. We've repeatedly, it was our point of error in the Court of Appeals, it was everything we argued in our brief of appellant. I think it's clearly preserved. Now,
another thing they argue is that this argument's all well and good, but it's not the law that applies in Minnesota. So if we were to find Minnesota law applies, then wouldn't we follow alternative C?
Right, alternative C. But what we're talking about is, how do you properly construe alternative C? What does alternative C mean? And Beaumont says that alternative C means anybody that's reasonably expected, because that's what the statute says on its face. And we're saying that if the Beaumont Court had done what you're supposed to do under the Uniform Commercial Code, which, for example, go to the official comment, look at the official comments to alternative C, that tell you that you should follow Restatement of Torts 402A. Now, that means something. The Beaumont Court said, well, we're going to disregard that comment because this isn't a 402A case. But the reason that that comment is in there is to give the courts a hint. It's a red flag about where is the right place to draw the line. And indeed, the Fifth Circuit has said in the Keith case that this is where you would draw the line if you were drawing it for Texas. That you'd say it's okay to recover pure economic losses if you're in the chain of distribution. But if you go outside the chain of distribution, you should draw the line at pure economic losses. And that's what we think that comment was intended to tell you. That's what the commentators say the comment was intended to go to. That the editorial board writers that were working on the restatement intended to draw a line at pure economic losses. And that's a good place to draw the line, Your Honor, because it's a bright line. It's a bright line workable test as opposed to an ad hoc determination in every case of whether particular plaintiffs are going to be deemed to be legally foreseeable. And that's what they have to argue for. You see, they can't stand up here and say it's the bridge. They can't claim that everybody recovers. So what they've got to argue for is that there's an ad hoc determination on a case-by-case basis, and we don't think that's the right place to draw the line. Thank you.
Any other?
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Thank you, Mr. Court. Mr. William Power will present argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Before getting into the choice of law issue, which I do intend to address, and the meaning of Section 2318, I'd like to clarify, if I may, the nature of this business transaction. The 3M tries to paint this as a buyer and a seller over here and a totally unrelated purchaser or plaintiff over here. In fact, the reality of this business transaction is very different from that. Jim Bainbridge is an entrepreneur who acquired the worldwide rights to 3D camera technology. To make this technology work, he needed a specialized film emulsion and specialized backcoating to make the prints. So in 1988, he personally went to Minnesota and met with 3M Vice President Roger Lorenzini. He explained to Lorenzini that he was going to make printers and print material. He explained personally to Lorenzini that he was going to process 3D photographs. He explained personally to Lorenzini that he was going to manufacture and sell 3D cameras. And he explained personally to Lorenzini that he was going to manufacture these cameras in Hong Kong. Now, none of these individual projects could work alone. No one will process the film if there aren't any cameras. No one will buy cameras if there isn't any film. Bainbridge couldn't do any of these things alone. And he couldn't do any of them unless he had the right emulsions and the right backcoat. And he explained that to 3M. In fact, Bainbridge was 3M's only customer for this specific process product. So 3M sales depended upon the interrelationship of these different enterprises. Now, if Bainbridge had done this all in one company, there would be no privity problem at all. He could recover for the camera sale. But he had a different internal business organization. He had different companies process the film from sell the cameras. And 3M now claims that internal business decision makes all the difference in the world in his relationship with 3M. 3M's position here just exalts form over substance. It's contrary to the whole idea behind the Uniform Commercial Code. When Carl Llewellyn and the other drafters of the Uniform Commercial Code put it together, they were fighting against Williston's formalistic contract theory, a formalistic contract theory that exalted the form of transactions over the substance of transactions. This is especially true for the problem of privity. Ever since the McPherson case, the problem of privity was to overcome the problem that in modern business transactions, people always don't deal face-to-face.
But when they got to this point, they weren't sure which way to go. When they got to 2.318, they weren't sure which way to go.
Well, there is a difference as to how far the privity requirement goes. But the one thing that the privity requirement was not intended to do was be a defense against somebody you're sitting across the table from arguing or negotiating face to face, and that's what happened in this case. If Jim Bainbridge and Roger Lorenzini negotiated face to face with all of these projects in mind.
If they weren't, if one of these companies, if the manufacturer, for example, were a totally unrelated entity, how would that affect your argument?
If it was a totally unrelated entity, then we would get into the 2318 argument. Our position would be that under 2318 in Minnesota, if they were reasonably expected to be affected, they would not be denied a privity argument. But that does not mean they would get to recover. 3M comes in and acts like the Court of Appeals went off the deep end, that they're having unlimited liability. The only way to prevent unlimited liability is to draw the line with the privity requirement. That wasn't the intent of the privity requirement, even in jurisdictions that have a narrow privity requirement. The place the code limits consequential damages to keep them from going on forever is in section 2715. That's the damages section of the code. Question 13 in our case was submitted under the language of section 2715. 2715 does not permit recovery of consequential economic damages unless the seller has reason to know of the particular business purposes of the plaintiff.
Well, but you began the argument by saying, surely you know there's a camera manufacturer out there somewhere.
That's not enough under 2715. It's not that you should have known or could have known. This is the famous rule of Hadley v. Baxendale in contracts. That is, the buyer, the plaintiff, has to actually disclose information to the seller in order to recover economic consequential damages under 2715.
But if the buyer came in and said, well, of course, you understand, we're going to use this film, we're going to manufacture cameras, we're going to sell cameras, they're going to sell batteries, they're going to sell stands to put the camera on, they're going to sell bags to put the camera in, and it just goes without saying that it's all hinging on whether this product works.
These are our business purposes.
Well,
Kodak's business purposes.
Well, but we can't sell we want to take what you give us and sell it to other people to sell to the public. And we're going to get cut out if the people on the end aren't making sales.
If we disclose our business purposes, then under 2715, we can recover. Now, that doesn't mean that 3M is in a hopeless position. The code has disclaimers of warranties. 2719 has remedy limitations. All they have to do is have a remedy limitation for consequential damages. The key here is that we have to disclose our business purposes so they know whether or not they need to limit against consequential damages. But under 2715, the people on the other side of the bridge couldn't recover because they didn't disclose their business purposes. Kodak or the other battery manufacturers could not recover. It's simply not the case that the Beaumont Court of Appeals has gone off the deep end here. The authors of the code weren't stupid. They understood that there was extensive liability under 2318. But the backup is there's limited liability. It's not just foreseeability, but it's disclosed businesses purposes under 2715. That's the way our case was submitted to the jury. They tracked the language of 2715, as you can see on the chart. That's the limitation. Now, of course, under that standard, we easily recovered. We disclosed our business purposes. Not only did 3M have reason to know of our business purposes, they actually knew of our business purposes. But if I could, Your Honor, I'd like to come back to this idea of what 3M is doing with privity generally. They are using...
Mr. Power, before you move on, would you speak to the choice of law issue of why Nevada and Georgia are not the state with the most significant contacts and option A should apply?
Yes, I'd be happy to, Your Honor. Minnesota clearly does have the most significant contacts in this situation, not just counting them up, as 3M says we're doing, but given the particular issues in the case. Now, they have a fundamentally flawed view of what choice of law analysis is like. They think we're going to compare Minnesota to the rest of the world. The task is to compare Minnesota to other individual states. That's why in the trial court, when the trial judge asked them whose law applies, they said, we don't have to tell you. Now, that puts the trial judge in an intolerable situation. How can the trial judge identify content of people's law?
You argue that here, and you argue that in the brief, but they put up some references to the statement of fact where they were clearly arguing that Nevada law applied.
They are now arguing that Nevada law applied.
What was put up on the easily here was incorrect. They purported to be, from the statement of facts, matters that they argued in the trial court.
They argued that alternative A applied, but when asked why alternative A applied, they didn't say, we think Nevada law is applying. They didn't make a motion under Texas Rule of Evidence 202 to have the judge take judicial notice of the of Nevada law. They just said, we think A applies, and A is out there a lot, and therefore it's Minnesota against the rest of the world. Another fundamental flaw in their choice of law analysis, Your Honor, is that they assume that Georgia law and Nevada law, because of adopted A, are the same. That's simply not true. Alternative A, in the comments, I believe it's comment 3 to alternative A, specifically states that the rule in alternative A is a minimum and it is not to discourage courts from going further, maybe even all the way out to C, even without the legislature adopting Alternative A. For example, Pennsylvania lets employees of the purchaser recover, even though they've adopted Alternative A. So we don't know that Georgia and Nevada have the same rule. They've never brought that to our attention or to the trial judge's attention so the trial judge could make a choice of law analysis. Again, they've got an obligation under Rule 202 to move the trial judge to take notice of Nevada's law or Georgia's law if they want Nevada's law.
So what you're saying is they did not comply with Rule 202?
Well, they didn't comply with Rule 202, and the 202 does say that the trial judge can take judicial notice on his own motion, but the Good and Wellborn treatise on this is very clear on it, and they cite cases, and that is whether the trial judge takes discretion, takes judicial notice on his own motion is within the trial judge's discretion. And they quote, they say, quote, the party who does not make a motion cannot complain. Now,
so you're saying that since they didn't perfect a motion under 202, they have no right to complain now?
That's correct, but also it would make choice of law analysis in the trial court totally unworkable. The trial judge would have to be one of the advocates. We come in and say Minnesota law applies. They literally said, we don't have to tell you. So the trial judge would have to go around, find the other laws, and if the trial judge got it wrong, would be reversed on appeal. Now, it's true that choice of law is de novo once the issue is joined, but they should have to come in and put the material before the trial judge.
I understand the buyer has disclosed the business purpose, but it seems to me that this is more than simply a form over substance. If a buyer could go to 3M, say, 3M, I'm going to be developing cameras, and I'm going to be developing film, and I'm going to be selling those cameras, and 3M says, okay, I understand what you're planning on doing, it seems to me your argument would permit the buyer then to go away and form the manufacturer and then a distributor for West California and a distributor for East California and a distributor for West Nevada and a distributor for East Nevada and bring all those people in there who I assume each of those enterprises would tack on an additional profit over and above the cost. So I manufacture the camera and then I sell it to myself at a profit and then myself sells the camera to the public for an additional profit. It seems to me that the rationale you apply here would permit a buyer to basically create any number of business organizations all performing the same central function, but each one claiming for itself an additional profit over and above the original profit from the original manufacturer of the camera.
Well, if we go in and disclose that we're going to market cameras in California, then we can't tack on marketing cameras in England or Massachusetts or someplace else. We haven't disclosed our business purposes. But it's clear here we were going to be the worldwide sellers of these cameras.
True,
so we haven't expanded our business.
But you would claim a profit for the worldwide sale of cameras just from the manufacturing and initial sale of the camera. But over here you also have an American distributor of that camera who I assume would claim a profit on top of the cost of the camera to the distributor, which included a profit to the manufacturer.
Well, that's assuming we could do it economically in the marketplace. We're going to be tested on the marketplace as to whether we can sell cameras. And we're not going to be able to...
But under the UCC, would 3M be responsible for... I mean, under the UCC, you're saying all I have to do is disclose my business concept, and then that covers this concern. And I'm saying, but would the UCC really anticipate a seller would be responsible for the individual business enterprise profits that the buyer might ultimately set up just internally for the purposes of selling cameras and marketing and manufacturing?
Well, a couple of points, Your Honor. First, each part of this enterprise was disclosed. Now, it wasn't called Mashika at the time, it was Quantronics, but the possibility of these enterprises taking place were disclosed. There wasn't layering going on beyond which 3M had reason to know. If we came in and simply layered in a way to up the damages, there are rules on mitigation of damages. Right? If we've upped the damages in an artificial way, then we really haven't been damaged. The UCC has cover requirements and substitute requirements. We can't simply artificially up the damages by some artificial marketing process. It does take effort to get the cameras out on the market from the manufacturer, so the profit to American 3D is a legitimate profit here, and we disclosed that and explained it to 3M.
A moment ago you said this this meeting or meetings were in Minnesota, and I thought opposing counsel said there was some meeting in Georgia.
Well, there were contacts all over the country. We can get up, they can get up, and we can list contacts. The important contacts took place in Minnesota. These contacts, and I'd like to explain why. Even if we are now comparing Nevada and Minnesota, it is clear that if you look at the issues involved in this case, they took place in Minnesota. The two issues in this case are the privity requirement. That understands, or that relies on a judgment as to whether Bainbridge and Warren Zeeney, that is 3M, were dealing face-to-face. How that business relationship was established, what was disclosed, whether the privacy requirement is going to apply, all that took place in Minnesota. The damages under 2715, the rule that we were just going through as to whether we disclosed our business purposes, whether we can recover under 2715, Your Honor, that is, under the submission as it was submitted to the jury, whether we can recover under that depends on what we disclose about our business purposes. All that took place in Minnesota. On top of that, there's an implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose here under 2315. That's one of the three warranties that we recovered under. The implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose requires the seller to be aware that the buyer has a particular purpose, requires the seller to be aware that the buyer is depending on the seller's judgment. That depends on what information was given from the buyer to the seller. And all that took place in Minnesota. It doesn't matter where the product was delivered. Though, by the way, some of the product was delivered FOB Minnesota. Wasn't all delivered in Nevada.
Or was it mixed?
I believe, and I'm not absolutely sure of this, Your Honor, some of it was delivered to Oklahoma. It was either some of it mixed there or mixed in Nevada. But the mixing of it, and let's suppose it all got mixed in Nevada. The mixing of it isn't what this case turns on.
Well, if the contacts were in Mexico, would you be standing here arguing that Mexico lawful? If the contacts that you've discussed, if that occurred in Mexico as opposed to Minnesota, would you be arguing that we don't apply the UCC at all, that Mexico law governs?
If we'd have to look at Mexico law. Choice of law analysis isn't just counting conduct, it's looking at their underlying law. If they had an underlying law that depended upon where the disclosures were being made, and frankly, I don't know what Mexican law is on the issue of damages under what we would call 2715 or the implied warrant of mischievability under 2315. I don't know what their law is. If their law only created those warranties or only permitted damages, if the business purposes were disclosed, then yes, Mexican law would apply to that transaction.
But if they have no UCC, no breach of warranty, and you're going to...
Well, they have contract law, though. They do have a code. They have a contract.
You're parsing it down to individual elements as opposed to stepping back and saying, do they have a UCC provision? Does it govern this transaction? Now you're saying that you look at the individual legal disputes within each category, determine category by category?
That is clearly the way interest analysis and choice of law was designed to work. It might very well be in a case that Texas law applies to the damage issues and Nebraska law applies to some other issue. You look at the particular issues, the particular policies of each
jurisdiction.
So we
decide liability under Nevada law and damages under Minnesota law?
Well, that's possible. Now, that's what's called depassage. That's taking part of one law and part of another law. It is cumbersome. One of the elements under Section 6 of the Restatement Second is to look at the workability. And so the trial court might take workability into account and decide that they don't want to split it up. But yes, it's an issue-by-issue analysis, and I think that's just standard choice of law analysis. Generally, it will come in the issue of damages or remedy limitations or things of that sort might be from one state's law, and the actual conduct, like say the negligence standard, would be from another state's law.
If Minnesota law applies and it was applied correctly below, then judgment can be rendered. If Nevada law applies, what should the result be?
Judgment should be rendered for Nashika. And here's the reason I'd like to come back to what I opened up with. These people dealt face to face. The whole point of the UCC was to not exalt the form of a business transaction over the substance of a business transaction. Three, and that's especially true, as I pointed out, on privity. The whole point of privity, I think, McPherson, was to relax the privity requirement because sometimes people don't always deal face-to-face. 3M's turning this on its head. They're arguing that people that dealt face-to-face should be precluded on the ground of privity. Again, that turns the whole development in the UCC right on its head.
Aren't you overlooking the fact that we have four different legal entities involved here? I mean, you just gloss over that fact and say they're one and the same.
I don't gloss over it, Your Honor. What I'm saying is, in the relationship between 3M and Bainbridge, Bainbridge went in there and said, here are my business plans. I need this stuff or it's going to ruin me. Whether he did it in one company or four companies doesn't alter this relationship. Again, it's exalting form over substance, which is exactly what the Uniform Commercial Code was designed to prevent. If Carl Llewellyn saw this argument that 3M was making, I guarantee you, Your Honor, he would turn over in his grave. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, please.
Your Honor, Justice Gonzalez hit the nail right on the head. Their poster here, if you could leave this up for a second, their poster says that Tony Thomas was part of this group that allegedly sat across the table when Mr. Bainbridge was across the table from us telling us their business plan. At the time these goods were sold, Mr. Bainbridge had no ownership interest whatsoever in Quantronics. And at the time these goods were sold, Nishika Manufacturing, which is the company he created later, did not even exist. They never told us about Nishika Manufacturing. And he didn't have, Mr. Bainbridge, who sat across the table from us, had no ownership interest whatsoever in Quantronics. He keeps talking about a buyer, and he cites to you 2715 of the UCC that talks about the limitations on a buyer's damages, because he's trying to treat all of these folks as if they were the buyer. But as Judge Gonzalez points out, they're separate legal entities, and they're not even all Bainbridge entities. You can't even throw a Bainbridge net over this and claim that it's all Mr. Bainbridge, because it wasn't. And
see, if I understood Mr. Powers' argument, though, it was that Bainbridge tells 3M, I'm going to create this enterprise. This is the enterprise I'm going to create. A part of that enterprise is the manufacturing of 3D camera.
Right.
And he argues that 3M didn't manufacture this emulsion and backsauce, but 3M was saying, we will manufacture a emulsion and backsauce for this enterprise.
Right. But Judge,
so doesn't that really go against your argument? Well, he didn't own it. Well, I mean, his whole point was, I'm going to get one.
But he didn't get one. I mean, at the time we were selling the goods, whatever he told us he was going to do, he hadn't done. Mr. Fingerette was the fellow that owned Quantronics at the time we sold the goods. So if it's all based on Mr. Bainbridge, who, by the way, is not a plaintiff here. I mean, there's such a thing as juridical persons. And the plaintiff here is not Mr. Bainbridge. We don't have some alter ego finding here. We're faced with separate corporate plaintiffs. And they didn't sit across the table from us, and certainly Quantronics didn't, because Mr. Bainbridge didn't have anything to do with Quantronics when we sold the goods. So his whole thesis is based on the flawed assumption.
But
and there's
they had sat across the table, would it be different?
It would not be different in our view, because, you see, it's different under Mr. Powers' analysis, because Mr. Powers wants you to draw the line of legal recoverability under 231A based on who the buyer happens to tell the manufacturer about. And we're saying that's not the proper place to draw the line. If manufacturers have to believe when they sell their goods that a court is going to determine after the fact on an ad hoc basis, case by case, where are we going to draw the line on these pure economic losses? Well, this group might be foreseeable, this other group might be foreseeable. As you said, Judge, maybe it's the camera manufacturer, maybe it's the camera accessory seller. I can't limit that exposure. I would have to disclaim Mr. Powers is right. If the UCC was construed the way they want it construed on an ad hoc case-by-case basis on whether these people for pure economic losses outside the chain are going to be foreseeable, I'd have to disclaim that's right. And even direct purchasers, even direct buyers won't be able to get a warranty, because sellers are always going to have to disclaim, because they can't take a chance on owing a warranty to the world based on a court determination after the fact on an ad hoc basis as to where the liability stops.
But it seems like the bigger the industry, the less liability. And that, that seems to be counterintuitive, that if this were just a little camera operator who was doing the whole thing in-house, then he'd have a claim. But because the industry is big enough that it's got to be separated out among different owners, then they don't have
Judge, if he was a buyer, if he was in the chain of distribution, who had someone who had directly or indirectly acquired the product, he'd have a claim. But our whole position is that the right way to construe alternative C is that if he's not a buyer, if he's outside the chain of distribution, regardless of the size of the industry, that that's the appropriate place to draw the bright line test, is that economic loss. If you notice, Mr. Powers didn't say anything about that comment 3 to UCC section 231A, you didn't hear anything about that. And keep in mind that no court in the country, no court except for Beaumont, has ever held that somebody outside the chain of distribution can recover pure economic loss. No court. And if this opinion is not changed by this court, it'll be in the case books. Mr. Powers can teach it in law school if he teaches UCC, because it'll be the only case that holds that somebody outside the chain of distribution can recover pure economic loss. And it's incorrect. It's not, Your Honors, what this court would say the law is for Texas. Now, if you don't, according to the Fifth Circuit, and on the Fifth Circuit panel, there were two Texas judges, Judge Higginbotham and Judge Goldberg, and they looked at your cases and they said this court would draw the line at pure economic losses for people outside the chain of distribution. Now, that's what you would do, because
we've got to draw it. We're in Minnesota.
Well, you've got to construe a uniform statute, UCC section 2318. And every time you go look at a uniform provision, you would look at the official comments. Why do they ignore the official comments? Because they don't have a good answer to that reference to 402A that tells you to draw the line at pure economic loss.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the morning set of arguments. The marshal will please adjourn.
All right. Okay.